for this Tuesday, the first day of September. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. Traveling with the Attorney General and the Acting Homeland Security Secretary, President Trump touring parts of Kenosha, Wisconsin, but did not meet with the family of the shooting victim, which started the latest protest, 29-year-old Jacob Blake. Meanwhile, in an interview with a Pittsburgh television station, the Democratic nominee, former Vice President Joe Biden, saying the president is, in fact, stoking hatred and violence across the country. And the latest on coronavirus, children in Wuhan, China, where the virus originated, returning to school today. It comes as the New York City public school system pushing back the start date of its new school year from September the 10th to September 21st as part of an agreement to avoid a teacher strike. The White House set to resume public tours on September the 12th with reduced capacity, social distancing, and face masks required. And in Iowa, Iowa State University planning to allow as many as 25,000 fans into its stadium for that school's home opener on September 12th. The story shaping Washington Today, it's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with today's congressional hearing focused on a coronavirus relief bill, and among those testifying, the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin rejecting a Democratic offer of a $2.2 trillion relief package. It comes as lawmakers question him on the pandemic, the economy, and its impact long-term on the country. The Treasury Secretary offered this assessment of where negotiations are between the parties and the two chambers.
I do not support $2.2 trillion, but what's more important is what is the breakdown in getting money to American workers, American families, kids, where we can agree on money. There is tremendous areas of agreement, and that's what we should be doing right away.
Oh, so what are those areas of agreement?
Oh, I believe there's enormous agreement on the PPP. I want to thank you and others. I think on a bipartisan basis, the committees here in the Senate have made improvements to the PPP going forward. I think there's an agreement on money for schools. There may be a difference as to what it is. There's an agreement on enhanced unemployment going forward. There may be a slight disagreement in what the amount is in calculation. I think there's been an agreement on direct payments, as I mentioned earlier. There was even an agreement on postal, which seems to have more excitement and more interest in the postal has ever had in the history of time, but there's plenty of areas of agreement where we may be differing on amount. But again, my strong...
If I may, your big disagreement is on city and state. Is that right?
Again, it's...
Jordan keeps saying they have plenty of money.
I'm not so sure
that's true.
Chair Waters, I want to be careful because I think it is hard to negotiate in a public agreement in a public way. But I would say we conceded, Chief Meadows and I, on behalf of the president. We had reviewed this with the president in an effort to get a deal done and get other things that are very important for the American public, even agreed to put more money on the table for cities and states. Unfortunately, Senator Schumer and Speaker Pelosi do not want to sit down at the negotiating table unless we publicly agree on a top line. My own opinion is we should go piece by piece in any area of the legislation we can agree on. We should have the House and the Senate pass.
You heard Representative Maxine Waters and, of course, the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. In fact, talks between Speaker Pelosi and White House officials led by the Treasury Secretary have been a hold since the two sides essentially walked away from the bargaining table on August the 7th, more than 3 weeks ago. In an interview with CNBC, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said aid to states and cities does remain the biggest obstacle to a relief deal. Democrats want $1 trillion just for that to help those governments deal with a growing budget shortfall. Mark Meadows saying that the Republicans would support about $150 billion in new funding for state and local governments. And in a separate interview with CNBC, one of the world's largest hedge fund executives saying that the U.S. economy continues to need significant fiscal support in order to sustain its recovery from the coronavirus-induced economic devastation. Greg Jensen is with Bridgewater Associates. His firm estimates that the price tag for another coronavirus relief bill will far exceed the $1 trillion mark. More from today's interview.
If you look at, we do the calculations on the impact fiscal policy is having across countries. And in the U.S. case, we think fiscal policy has driven the GDP level up about 7% relative to where it would have been on a level basis. So a huge impact. And the fade, the fiscal cliff we face here is large, that you'll see a big drawdown if they don't extend the fiscal benefits that are necessary. So that's a big deal. And 500 would create a very significant cliff. So to us, this, our kind of estimate of what would continue to sustain the economy in the way that it's been going is somewhere in the 1.3 to 1.7 kind of range. And it depends what it's used for. There's different types of policy. The policy that gets directly spent in the economy is much more effective per dollar than the dollar that's preventing more bad things from happening. So there's a mix in this package. The money from states is going to prevent negatives. The stimulus checks will be direct positives. It's monitoring those things. And that's a good example of the challenge of trading markets and understanding economies today, because we've gone over from the last 40 years of, let's say, a more capitalist system where the monetary policy is driving the cycles and private sector entities are reacting to them. Now the biggest driver in the economy are these fiscal choices. And so many different choices are being made across countries on how to do monetary and fiscal policy. And that's having a huge impact on the differentials. So it's going to be a big deal. Now, in the short term, maybe they come up short. In the longer term, we think the basic issue is you're heading in this direction where they've learned the lesson that they're going to spend money and print money until they can't. And that's the path that they're on. And so they might come up short in this policy, but longer term, they're going to keep printing and spending until they hit the wall. The wall will be marked by inflation and currency. And so for us, I think the broader positioning should be consistent with governments printing money and spending money until you see problematic inflation, which, as the Fed has described, is significantly higher than their inflation target. So we're going to see this play out. You'll have the seesaw of politics make it more difficult. But largely, you're eventually going to get spending and printing until you hit that secular turning point where that becomes too inflationary.
Those comments from Greg Jensen. He is with the hedge fund firm Bridgewater Associates. The full interview courtesy of CNBC. Now to the president, who traveled to Kenosha, Wisconsin today. It has, of course, been the site of unrest in the wake of the police shooting of Jacob Blake, 29 years old. Despite calls by the governor and the mayor of the city to stay away, the president viewing property damage. He also held a roundtable on community safety. The trip comes as the president seeks to frame the race in this election against his Democratic opponent Joe Biden around law enforcement issues. More from Wisconsin.
You know, the sad thing is you can do 10,000 great jobs as a policeman or a policewoman. You can do an incredible job for years, and then you have one bad apple or something happens that's bad. And that's the nightly news for 3 weeks. That's all they talk about. They don't talk about the thousands and thousands of good jobs, the lives that you save, they never talk about. So I'm committed to helping Kenosha rebuild. We all are. We will provide $1 million to the Kenosha law enforcement so that you have some extra money to go out and do what you have to do. You took a rough — it was a rough week, to put it mildly, and you've done it incredibly well. I'm also providing nearly $4 million to support these small businesses that I talked about today that got burned up, burned down. And we're going to be providing over $42 million to support public safety statewide, including direct support for law enforcement and funding for additional prosecutors to punish criminals and resources to provide services to victims of crime. And that was Bill Barr wanted that money put in. So that's $42 million that'll help with prosecutors and all of the other things that are so important to you. You need that, because when you grab them and then nothing happens and they're back on the street, that doesn't work out too well. My administration is restoring public safety. We're hiring more police, surging tough-on-crime federal prosecutors, increasing penalties for assaulting law enforcement, and for dismantling Antifa. They don't want to mention the word Antifa. Nobody mentions it. This is a bad group of people. Very, very bad, very dangerous group of people. And we are doing a big number on Antifa. They're bad. Earlier this year, we announced Operation Legend to surge federal law enforcement to high-crime neighborhoods. It is a thing that has really worked out amazingly well, Bill, but it's really understated in a sense. We We've already conducted more than 1,000 arrests in our first month in Chicago. We went to Chicago very recently. Obviously, that's been a disaster, Chicago, total disaster, with, again, radical left Democrat, and we just have to straight. It's all Democrat. Everything's Democrat. All of these problems are Democrat cities. We don't want to say it, but it is. The top 10 are Democrat, then you go into the top 25 and take a look at that. It's the same thing. We cut the number of murders in Chicago last month in half. Still way too many, but they Operation Legend was very, very, very successful. Now it's just really getting going, but they cut it in half and just at its very early stage. This is in sharp contrast to those who want to slash police funding, oppose using the National Guard, and want to hire radical judges and prosecutors who will release rioters, looters, and criminals. We have that in Portland, where the prosecutors don't want to do anything. You can catch somebody doing the worst crime, and they don't want to do anything.
This headline at thehill.com, Wisconsin taking center stage in the Biden-Trump fight. And joining us on the phone from New York is Amy Parnes. She is covering this story. This is a battleground state. We saw that in 2016, certainly seeing that today. But it's also now part of the national debate over race relations in our country.
It is, Stephen. Both sides are making this state and what is happening there a big issue. You saw President Trump flying there today to go to Kenosha to talk to kind of bolster his message around law and order. And you're seeing the former Vice President Joe Biden kind of taking issue and fighting back and saying, you know, also defending his position and saying, okay, looting is not a good thing, but I do support what the protesters are doing. And I, more than anything, I support what is happening, why these protesters are demonstrating. And I think that is sort of why you're seeing this state kind of be center stage. And it's really interesting because a lot of people, a lot of Democrats, point to Wisconsin as a place that should have been won by Hillary Clinton in 2016. And here they are. There's a 4-point difference right now in the polls. And Joe Biden has the lead, but political observers on the ground say anything can happen. And that's why I think you're seeing President Trump put in such an effort right now.
And you make the point in your story that in early August of 2016, Hillary Clinton had a 10-point advantage in Wisconsin based on a Marquette University Law School poll. And now, as you mentioned, a 4-point lead for Joe Biden. That essentially is within the margin of error.
Exactly. And Democrats are basically pointing to the state and saying we cannot have deja vu in this place ever again. And that is why you're seeing, you know, Biden is getting scrutiny for not going. Some people that I talked to even last week and the week before were kind of questioning, these are Democrats, were questioning why Biden didn't even make the effort, or someone high up in the Democratic Party didn't really make the effort to at least touch ground during the convention there. They definitely don't want another 2016, and they're saying that Wisconsin obviously is very, very important.
Important, and for the Democrats, it's essentially critical, isn't it?
It's critical, and you're going to see, I think that's why reporters asked the former vice president if he was planning on traveling there. His campaign is trying to make an effort to send him to places. There's been a lot of scrutiny also on his travel schedule, especially in the final weeks of the campaign. People say that he can't, even though there is a pandemic happening. Democrats are forcing him out there and saying, you can't stay at home. You have to go out there and campaign. We can't take anything for granted. And complacency is one of their big fears right now. So I think that's why you're seeing this push on both sides to make, build whatever outreach they can right now in these critical months.
And let's talk about the president who went to Kenosha, Wisconsin today, despite the request by the Democratic governor and the mayor of Kenosha to stay away.
Yes, and he went there anyway. He really wants to, this is the president, wants to push his law and order message, and he's been making Kenosha and Portland, he's been highlighting them as two places that are run by Democrats and they're out of control. And he went there not really to back the protesters, to denounce the shooting that went down, but to actually say, to defend what is happening. And you heard him, or read him yesterday, rather, on Twitter saying, look, if if not for me, if not what I had done by sending in the National Guard, there wouldn't have been a Kenosha. So he is really kind of doubling down on his message and using this incident, this event, as proof of his case and what he tried to spell out at the Republican National Convention.
And one final point from your reporting, the warning signs, not only for the president, but also for the Biden campaign. What are they?
I think the biggest warnings right now are actually complacency. The polling is obviously something that is fresh on the minds of voters from 2016. They don't want to take Wisconsin or any battleground state for granted. And so I think a lot of people are saying this state could go to President Trump again, or it could go to the former Vice President Joe Biden. And so I think that is why you're seeing such an effort there. There is, like, as you mentioned, a 4-point lead right now for Biden. But because of what happened in 2016, because it kind of polling kind of swung back and forth, I think everyone is sort of on high alert right now. And that's why you're seeing this this effort on the ground on both from both campaigns.
Battleground State, Wisconsin, Amy Parnes, her work available at thehill.com. As always, we thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Meanwhile, the assistant coach for the Milwaukee Bucks, Vin Baker, saying the White House senior advisor, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, showed what he called, quote, a level of ignorance with his remarks about NBA players and their refusal to take to the court after the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. The home arena for the Bucks is in downtown Milwaukee. It's about 40 miles north of Kenosha. Last week, the president's son-in-law was dismissive of the NBA players, stating that they were fortunate to, quote, have the financial position to take the night off, calling it a luxury. Political's Jake Sherman with this question to the assistant coach, Vin Baker.
To add one more thing, I want to get you to react to this. Jared Kushner, who's the president's son-in-law and top advisor, was on a similar interview with us last week and said, well, it's nice that the NBA players can do this because they could afford to take the night off. I wonder what your reaction is to that.
Well, I think there's a level of insensitive, and it's a level of, you know, there's no sensitivity there. I don't obviously agree with the comment. There's a level of ignorance there. This wasn't about us affording to be able to take the night off. Again, this was about us, you know, seeing an egregious act, another one, yet another egregious act in our country and in our own backyard. And it hit us in a place where it should hit everyone. Not just the Milwaukee Bucks, not just our players and our staff and our organization, but everyone should have been angry about what we saw. And, you know, it was a basketball game, and we decided to not play a basketball game. And so this had nothing to do with financial ramifications or what we were thinking about that was in our accounts, or not even what was at stake. I mean, this is the NBA playoffs, which is we obviously have a level of care about what we are doing here in Orlando, and we want to be successful. So it wasn't an easy decision for us at all. Again, it came from the heart. It was compassion for a fellow brother, a fellow family. And I would say we would do it again if we had the opportunity and if that situation came again. And hopefully it doesn't. Hopefully we've made a statement, and hopefully we can get some changes from what we did, the act that we did. I hope that we find ourselves on the right side of history.
Vin Baker is the assistant head coach for the Milwaukee Bucks, and the full interview is available at politico.com. Meanwhile, the Biden campaign today releasing a new 15-minute video in which the former vice president and his running mate, California Senator Kamala Harris, portraying President Trump as incapable of managing the coronavirus crisis as we deal with the economic fallout. Here is a portion of the Q&A which focused on jobs and the U.S. economy.
You want to make this economy grow. You want to get it back. You got to give people a chance.
Right. What we have seen, again, is that this pandemic has highlighted the racial disparities that existed before. African Americans, before the pandemic, 20% more likely to have asthma, 40% more likely to have high blood pressure. Black women, 3 times more likely to have lupus, which is an autoimmune disease. And we know that this virus, it preys on people with pre-existing conditions. And so we've seen Blacks and Latinos twice as likely to die from this virus. One of the great things I love about our plan is that it takes into account racial disparities. It acknowledges it so that we make sure that we're putting resources in the communities that need them and do it in a way that everyone comes out equal.
That with Senator Kamala Harris, the Democratic vice presidential nominee. And yesterday, after a speech in Pittsburgh, Joe Biden conducting a number of local interviews, including this with WPXI, which is the NBC affiliate in southwestern Pennsylvania.
Listening to the experts, they've said to me, I laid out a detailed plan all the way back in March. Still hasn't gotten the protective gear to the people who need it. Our first responders, our nurses, our docs are still in trouble. They're dying. A lot of the providers are dying. The first responders are dying. What's he done? The reason why he's going after the whole idea of law and order, he can't say anything. He said nothing about the pandemic. Did you hear him talk about it at all? The thing that is on the road of killing 200,000 Americans, and now he heads up a new guy who's going to be his advisor on the pandemic, saying what we have to do is just let it spread. Let it spread, and that's the way we'll fix it? How many thousands more have to die? He has no plan. And as a convention, the part I heard was, they said this is going to be a new deal. A new make America great again. What has he done? He hadn't laid out anything. I laid out in detail what I would do to deal with getting kids back to school. I laid out in detail what we should be doing to make sure small businesses aren't closing. And this president spends more time in a sand trap playing golf than he does in the Oval Office negotiating with members of Congress how to get help, badly needed help, to cities from Pittsburgh to cities all across America. I managed the Recovery Act, which is $800 billion, when we inherited a near depression when we took office. And it came back. We brought the country back. The longest stretch of growth in history. Laid it on his doorstep. Like everything else he inherited, he squandered that.
That with Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential nominee, in an interview with WPXI-TV. Meanwhile, CNN political analyst Joe Lockhart is questioning whether the president had a stroke and that is he's hiding it from the American people. He did so on Twitter yesterday, saying, did at real Donald Trump have a stroke, which he is hiding from the American public? The president today denying that he made an emergency visit to the hospital last year after suffering what some claimed were a series of mini strokes. It comes after a new book claiming that the vice president, Mike Pence, was on standby in the event the president was incapacitated. Well, the president responding today on Twitter, quote, it never ends. Now they are trying to say that your favorite president, me, went to Walter Reed Medical Center having suffered a series of mini strokes. Never happened to this candidate. Calling it, quote, fake news. Michael Schmidt reported in his new book that Vice President Pence was told to be on standby to assume presidential powers last November in the event the president had to be sedated during a previously unscheduled visit to Walter Reed Medical Center. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. On this Monday, September 1st, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. It's also available as a podcast. Here are some campaign 2020 headlines. The Biden campaign raising more than $300 million in the month of August. That, by the way, is more than was raised in 2016 by both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump combined. A new tracking poll in Ohio giving the president a lead over Joe Biden, 50% to 45%. In Florida, the latest average giving Joe Biden a slight lead, ahead by the president by just 2 points, well within the margin of error. And in Arizona, another battleground state, the Biden campaign currently looking at a 10-point lead. These poll results can be found at realclearpolitics.com. Pennsylvania lawmakers calling on the Postmaster General to immediately return recently removed Postal Service sorting machines, stating in a letter released earlier today that their removals have caused a delay in mail delivery across the state. Democratic Senator Bob Casey, along with 9 Democratic House members and 1 GOP House member, sending the letter to the Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, saying that at least 30 sorting machines have been removed from facilities across the state. The lawmakers saying in a letter that was a direct response to DeJoy's testimony in front of the House last week, where the Postmaster General said he would not return decommissioned sorting machines, saying they are not needed. And in a related development in Pennsylvania, the governor, Tom Wolf, calling on the state Supreme Court to mandate counties to count ballots that are postmarked by Election Day and arrive up to 3 days after the election. Republicans, though, opposing that proposal. And now to the Federal Reserve. In a story for the Wall Street Journal, Nick Timiraos writes the following, quote, "In the past 6 months, it's shown that the Fed has far more powerless to avert financial panics by devising new emergency lending backstops. This is different from providing stimulus that can spur more lending and investments to support a recovery." The full story at WSJ.com. Meanwhile, the former head of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, participating in a discussion today on the path forward for the central bank and how this pandemic will impact American lives both short and long term. The full event has been posted at cspan.org. Here is part of that conversation.
The basic principle of central banking is you don't speculate about things until you're about ready to use them. So I wouldn't take, particularly about yield caps, I wouldn't take the somewhat mixed message we've been getting as ruling this out as something they might want to do in the future under appropriate circumstances. But there are tools, I think, that would be helpful to reach this this target in the longer term. Now, I should end by saying that we're in a very special circumstance, that the COVID-19 recession is different in many, many ways from a standard recession. And I don't think this is inconsistent with things I've said in the past. I don't think that monetary policy is the tool that's going to get us out of this recession. Number one by far is going to be the public health situation and getting that under control. Fiscal policy also has a very big role to play. Monetary policy can be helpful, but given this particular set of circumstances, it's not going to be the most important player in getting us back to full employment.
Right. Because I recall in your American Economic Association address and the work you did with Kiley and Roberts, you said the Fed had sufficient tools provided that the natural rate of interest was somewhat higher than we believe it is today.
Well, that's not quite true in that, the Fed's official, the SEP, the Summary of Economic Projections, has the natural rate of interest around 2.5%. And my conclusion from simulations was that with interest rates between 2 and 3%, that the tools we have can get us pretty much back to where we were before the constraint was binding. But that's a different situation from now. What you can think about now is that, at least for the time being, the fact that people are not spending because they're staying home means essentially that the IS curve has been, at least temporarily pushed down, that the neutral rate is lower than normal. So, My results from the lecture may apply in the longer term, but right now I think that monetary policy doesn't have by itself the power to overcome the effects of the virus.
Those comments from Ben Bernanke. He now serves as a Brookings Fellow, and he served as the Fed Chair during the last 2 years of the George W. Bush administration and the first 6 years of the Barack Obama administration. Well, as we all know, coronavirus has affected the U.S. economy on so many levels, including those coins in our piggy banks, dresser drawers, and car cup holders. Do you have some there? Have you noticed it? Have you noticed the signs at stores asking for coins or insisting credit card only, no cash accepted? We'll get some background in just a moment, but first, this public service announcement from the U.S. Mint.
Hi, I'm Dave Ryder, Director of the United States Mint. I have the distinct privilege of leading the employees who are manufacturing our nation's coins. I want to assure you that the men and women of the Mint workforce are working as hard as they possibly can to get newly produced coins into the economy. In fact, we are on track to mint more coins this year than we have produced in almost 20 years. But right now, coins aren't circulating through the economy as quickly as they were prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, which means that sometimes coins are not readily available where needed. This is not a coin supply problem, it's a circulation problem, and I'm here to ask you for your help. You can help get coins moving by using exact change when making purchases, taking your coins to financial institutions, or turning them in for cash at coin recycling kiosks. Every little bit helps, and please remember to follow all safety guidelines when you are out spending or recycling your coins. Together we can get coins moving again and into the hands of the people and businesses that need them. Thank you very much.
And the Washington Post is calling it the nation's great coin debacle. The headline at WashingtonPost.com, "A Penny Pinch, How America Fell into the Coin Shortage." Joining us on the phone is Rachel Siegel. She's economics reporter covering the Federal Reserve for The Washington Post and, for the purposes of today's conversation, covering the coin shortage. So how did we get to this point?
You know, it really is just 2020's latest plot twist. Basically, what happened was that as people stayed home, moved around less, spent less, when they did spend money, it was mostly online, their coins basically stayed in place with them. And I've been thinking of it sort of as like, you know, the water cycle for coins that filters coins through restaurants and retail stores and banks all the way back up to the Federal Reserve and the Mint. And that whole system pretty much just shut down as people were staying put to ride out the pandemic.
And your story talks about Daryl Johnson, who has the Giant Wash Coin Laundry. He's the chief executive of that operation. So how does he play into this story?
So he runs a chain of laundromats that runs, you know, mostly on quarters. He basically needs a lot of coins in order to run his day-to-day business. And he was noticing that, you know, the coins that normally weren't a problem at all were really just drying up. He was having to put up signs in his stores asking people to bring in any loose change that they had or to make sure that they weren't using the change machines and then taking those coins home with them. And at one point, he actually connected with another laundromat owner who was many hours away. And Daryl basically got in his car and went on this mission to basically pick up $8,000 worth of quarters that this other owner didn't need. And he wrote him a check and then drove home. So in that instance, you know, people were able to work together, but everyone's kind of looking out for, you know, how they can get these coins just to run their day-to-day business.
And we've all run into that, going to a store saying credit card only or a debit card, no cash.
Yeah, absolutely. It's come up in ice cream shops, at bank teller windows, laundromats, gas stations, restaurants. Then I came across a Chick-fil-A that is trying to entice people to bring in any rolled coins that they have, and in exchange you get dollar bills and a free sandwich. So it's been kind of fascinating just to see, you know, how many slices of the economy are touched by this. And really that, you know, it's not really a policy question. It's not a politics question. It's just that while this sort of level of the economy is really sitting still, you know, the wheels aren't really turning in the same way for coins either.
It's also become a hashtag on social media, get coin moving. But where is the U.S. Mint in all of this?
So the Mint had to scale back, you know, the production of coins earlier in the pandemic to make room for social distancing and make sure that all of the Mint's employees were safe. But they have since ramped back up, not only to the pace at which they were minting coins before, but even past that, and they're on track to mint many more coins than they have in years. But what the Mint is saying is, you know, even that's not going to be enough. They need people to bring coins into their banks, to coin recycling kiosks, to use exact change when you can. It's really this sort of like public service announcement to get everybody to do their part. There's a coin task force that's looking at ways to get this wheel turning again. And so even though the Mint is, you know, trying to ramp up its own production, this is sort of a problem that's solved by all of our own piggy banks and wallets and, you know, the coins that are collecting in our cup holders.
And that's something that all Americans can relate to. We have those in our drawers and in our cupboards. So how is all of this going to be resolved?
Time might tell. The task force is coming up with, you know, preliminary recommendations and is going to stay on top of the issue for as long as there needs to be. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said this summer that the expectation is that as more parts of the economy reopen, that will sort of help get coins back in circulation. But, you know, with so much of all the uncertainty that there is right now, a lot is going to depend on, are people comfortable going back out to their restaurants, going back out to stores? Are they comfortable just doing a lot of the same things that made it so that this wasn't ever really something that we had to think about before? That's something we're going to have to wait and see.
One other factor in all of this, Americans are concerned about touching things. So coins and dollar bills, is that a big factor in all of this?
You know, I am not a medical expert and can't prescribe one way or the other. That wasn't anything that came up in my reporting. My sense is that it's just a sort of general accumulation of people just not spending as much as opposed to intentionally not wanting to touch coins or not wanting to touch dollar bills. But I imagine that for some people, that's part of the calculation, too.
The Great Coin Shortage, the story at WashingtonPost.com, the reporting of Rachel Siegel. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the arrows were up, the Dow gaining 215 points, the S&P rose 26, the NASDAQ closing at a new record high, gaining 164 points. You've been listening to Washington Today for this Tuesday, September 1st. It's available as a podcast. You can check it out at cspan.org/podcasts. I'm Steve Scully. We thank you for listening.